In 1987, a Union Pacific train ran over the bodies of two Arkansas teenagers. The deaths of Kevin Ives and Don Henry shocked the community. What were they doing on the train tracks? Were they dead before the train hit them? And if so, who killed them? Initially ruled as accidental deaths by the authorities, suspicious circumstances surrounding the case led to speculation of foul play, theories of homicide, and a massive cover-up. They were dubbed the Train Track Boys, and despite extensive investigations, the truth behind what happened to them remains elusive, making it one of the most haunting unsolved cases in Arkansas history. Brace yourself, because this is one of those cases where the deeper we get, the more twisted it becomes. This is Avery After Dark, and I'm your host, Avery Ross. Around 4 a.m. on August 23rd, 1987, a 75-car, 6,000-ton Union Pacific cargo train was making its standard night run to the UP Freight Yard in North Little Rock, Arkansas. The train was over a mile long, traveling at a speed of 52 miles per hour. According to train engineer Stephen Schroyer, the ride had been smooth as they approached the quiet small town of Bryant, Arkansas. Traveling at this hour was usually serene, with the rhythmic clack of the tracks against the wheels. The train cut through sleepy towns and sprawling fields. When suddenly, Stephen looked and saw something ahead on the tracks. At first, he couldn't tell what it was, but as the train got closer, he became frantic. Stephen saw two teenage boys were lying motionless across the railroad tracks, side by side, partially covered by what looked like a green tarp. Horrified, Stephen quickly placed the train into an emergency stop position and began laying down on the horn, hoping the boys would jump up and get off the tracks. But Stephen saw they didn't move. They didn't even flinch. The train was unable to stop in time, and within 3 seconds, the 6,000-ton locomotive ran over the boys. Stephen saying that 3 seconds doesn't seem like a long time, but it felt like an eternity for him as he knew what was about to happen. The immense weight of the train carried it for another half mile until it finally came to a stop. 911 is called immediately, and by 4:40 a.m., police arrived on the scene. Paramedics also get there, but there isn't anything they can do. The boys' bodies were terribly mangled, both pronounced dead. And because of the state of the bodies, police can't determine a cause or manner of death. Yes, they had just been hit by a 6,000-ton train, but when police speak with Stephen and some of the other engineers on the train, they learn that the boys didn't move at all before being hit. Investigators also discover a flashlight and a .22-caliber rifle near where the boys were lying on the tracks. Both items had been passed over by the train and were still intact. Residents in the small southern town began to wake up, and locals who live near the tracks noticed the police presence, many making their way down, learning about the tragedy. Word spreads fast, and the two teen boys were quickly identified as 16-year-old Don Henry and 17-year-old Kevin Ives. Don and Kevin were popular guys, best friends. The two were seniors at the Bryant, Arkansas High School. The state medical examiner, Dr. Fahmy Malik, said the two had been under the influence of marijuana and ruled the deaths accidental. But from the get-go, Don and Kevin's parents could not accept this. Nothing about any of this made any sense to the families, and they began a mission to find out what really happened to their sons. Firstly, Kevin's father, Larry, said he couldn't believe that his son was knocked out from marijuana or any drug, really. It was incredibly hard for them to believe that their sons fell asleep on the train tracks, something the boys had never done. Larry knew his son. They spent a lot of time together. He was usually at home when Kevin would return from school, and Kevin's mother, Linda, was always home at night. Neither of them ever recalled seeing Kevin passed out from drugs. According to friends and family, both Kevin and Don were very active teenagers. They loved working on cars, enjoyed hunting. It was said that Don was a really funny guy, a natural comedian, and his friend Kevin was his best audience. The duo doing everything together. The night of Saturday, August 22nd, Kevin and Don had gone out with some friends, meeting up on the outskirts of Little Rock at a favorite gathering spot for teenagers. The two guys left around midnight and went back to Don's house, and the evening wasn't over for the boys. They were going to head out hunting. Kevin waited on the porch while Don went inside to talk to his father, Curtis. Curtis said that Don came into his bedroom around 12:15 a.m., informing him that he and Kevin were going to go out hunting, saying the two spoke for about 15 minutes. Curtis said Don took his spotlight and his own rifle, and then the boys left. This was something they did frequently, so Curtis wasn't worried whatsoever. This particular night, Kevin and Don set off to go spotlighting, a form of night hunting which is illegal in Arkansas. Spotlight hunting is a method of hunting nocturnal animals, using off-road vehicles or high-powered lights. One of them would shine a light in the animal's eyes, transfixing the prey while the other fired. Spotlighting was pretty common among local boys at the time, and so far, Kevin and Don had avoided being caught doing this. So that night, the two went about their way, choosing their usual hunting route, walking along the railroad tracks that ran behind Don's house. It was close to 1 a.m. when the boys left. Then, around 4 a.m., Stephen Schroyer spotted the boys' bodies lying directly on the tracks. When interviewed, Stephen said it looked like the teenage boys had been laid out by someone. Positioned, they were laying side by side, exactly across the tracks. Very strange, their arms straight down by their sides, legs across the rails, and their torsos between the tracks. They were partially covered by that light green tarp Stephen had recalled seeing, and lying parallel to both of them was Don's .22 caliber rifle. Stephen said as the train approached, horn blasting, neither of them moved, not even so much as lifting their heads to look at the oncoming train. Why on earth were Kevin and Don lying side by side on the tracks? How could they have not heard the train horn blasting? Well, that state medical examiner, Dr. Malik, concluded the two teens had, quote, smoked the equivalent of 20 marijuana cigarettes, end quote. And he determined that the two had been in a deep sleep induced by the effects of marijuana and had never heard the oncoming train. And for the boys' parents, it was clear there wasn't going to be an investigation, with the official ruling being accidental. So the initial theory was, these boys went out to go hunting around midnight, and then became so stoned they decided to lay down on the train tracks and fall asleep. Don and Kevin's parents knew there was more to the story. They weren't going to accept this. We'll be right back. You're back with Avery After Dark. Linda Ives, Kevin's mother, wondered if they were that stoned, how were they able to lie down in identical positions? How would they have the mind to position themselves in such a way, so carefully placed? Train engineer Stephen Schroyer recalled that when he saw them, he said the teens looked like bodies lying in a morgue. Don and Kevin's families had the train sound checked and found that it was 98 decibels, which is equivalent to the sound of a jackhammer or an air compressor running. So, this was loud. The victims' families just didn't believe that anyone could sleep through that kind of commotion. And there was something specific that stuck out to Curtis, Don's father. He pointed out that Don's gun was discovered lying on the gravel. And he didn't believe Don would ever do that, because he wouldn't want the wood getting scratched. So Kevin and Don's parents set a meeting with Dr. Malik. They want more information, they need answers. And at this meeting, things go from confusing to downright bizarre. Linda Ives claimed that Dr. Malik was dodgy, with questions about exactly how much THC was found in the boys' systems. Linda also said that Dr. Malik consistently brought out autopsy photos of the boys to show the parents, even though they had specifically told him they didn't want to see the photos. This meeting left the parents with even more questions. So they decide to take matters into their own hands, reaching out to a pathologist in Tennessee named Dr. Francisco. They give him information on the case, and he agrees that he would look into it, but needs testable samples to do so. And this began a horrific back and forth. The parents get in contact with the crime lab, where the autopsies were performed, and they are met with resistance. Dr. Malik refuses to send the samples, so they hit a wall there. Kevin and Don's families then hire a private investigator and lawyer, hoping to obtain a court order to get the samples. But again, Dr. Malik refuses, defying this court order. So the parents then go higher up, reaching out to the district attorney's office, hoping the DA could get involved and force Dr. Malik to hand over the samples. This is really the point where my blood starts to boil with this case. These boys are their sons, their loved ones. If they want the samples to get a second opinion, a third opinion, a hundredth opinion, that is their right. That's their prerogative. And get this, in turn, the DA's office informs Don and Kevin's families that they can't help them. And furthermore, if the families sue Dr. Malik for defying the court order to hand over those samples, the DA's office will represent Dr. Malik in the case. So this wasn't just Dr. Malik. This resistance went all the way to the top. Then, in a strange turn of events, after this, something shifted for Dr. Malik, and he finally agrees to release the samples. So the families get them sent off to Dr. Francisco, but then he comes back to them and confirms Dr. Malik's findings, agreeing that the boys had high levels of THC in their systems. But for Linda Ives, her mother's intuition was telling her there was something very wrong here. So she goes through Dr. Francisco's reports and finds some inconsistencies. And when she reaches out to him about this, he admits to her that he actually didn't do any testing whatsoever. He just decided to agree with Dr. Malik's findings. Oh my gosh. I personally need to go check my blood pressure because this case has me worked up. I don't know about you guys. So again, the families found themselves at another dead end. So they came up with another idea. 5 months after their deaths, Kevin and Don's parents held a press conference. They were going public with this, hoping this publicity would force the authorities to reopen the investigation. And it worked. One day after the conference, the investigation was officially reopened. Newly appointed prosecutor Richard Garrett was like a breath of fresh air for the families. Richard meets with the parents and shares the family's suspicions. He doesn't believe it's very likely at all that the boys' deaths were accidental. He really dives into the case, and after a hearing, Kevin and Don's bodies were exhumed for a second autopsy to be performed by a noted expert at the University of Arkansas, Dr. Joseph Burton. He was chief medical examiner for North Metro Atlanta, a very well-respected professional. He performs these autopsies and comes back with some very disturbing discoveries. Ones that were most definitely not included in Dr. Malik's initial report. Firstly, Dr. Burton found a knife wound to Don's back, finding an identical gash in the t-shirt Don was wearing that night. And another injury was found on Kevin's cheek. Dr. Burton believed this injury was caused by being hit with the butt of that rifle the boys had taken with them that night. These injuries were not left by the train. These were inflicted before the men were hit. Dr. Burton also concluded that together, the boys had smoked not 20, but between 1 and 3 marijuana cigarettes. And friends who were with Don and Kevin earlier in the night confirmed this amount. Witnesses saying they saw the two smoke a bit, but not that much. So 1 to 2 joints paints a very different picture than 20. Definitely not enough to make the teens pass out on the train tracks. Another discovery: congestion was found in the boys' lungs, which, again, indicated that they had been hurt before being hit by the train. Dr. Burton was thorough, even having some of his colleagues back in Atlanta confirm his findings, and they all agreed. They believed that Dr. Malik was wrong. This was no accident. Don Henry and Kevin Ives were murdered. We'll be right back. You're back with Avery After Dark. A new analysis indicated that one of the boys was already dead and the other unconscious when the train hit them. It was concluded that Dr. Malik did not follow standard, proper procedures when conducting the autopsies. Additionally, many medical experts stated that it was very unlikely, if not impossible, for a person to straight up pass out from smoking marijuana. And it was even more unlikely that this would happen to two people at the exact same time. In July 1988, a grand jury reversed Dr. Malik's original finding of accidental death and officially ruled their deaths probable homicides. Now the question is, who would want to murder these two teen boys who didn't have any enemies, were well-liked in their town? So the investigation focused on that green tarp. When speaking to the parents, it was found that Kevin nor Don owned a tarp like that. So who did it belong to? And why was it draped over the bodies? All four of the people on the train, including Stephen, stated that the bodies were partially covered by the green tarp before the collision with the train. But it got really strange, as police who searched the scene later denied that Stephen had told them about the tarp. According to Stephen, it went so far as some officials questioning the existence of the tarp altogether. Stephen said this felt like this was questioning the existence of the bodies on the tracks because he was so certain the tarp was there, and that green tarp was never found. As the investigation continued, officials received an interesting tip. Locals said around the time Kevin and Don were killed, a man wearing military fatigues was seen in the area. And according to witnesses, his behavior was suspicious. And when police officer Danny Allen stopped to question this man about the case, he reportedly opened fire. Then the man ran off and disappeared. The area was searched, but they were never able to locate this man. They didn't know his name, and no one ever heard or saw him around town again. As time progressed, the boys' families became very cordial with Saline County prosecuting attorney, Dan Harmon. He was charming, and it seemed like the boys' families were finally getting a team of people together that were going to be in their corner and fight for justice. About a month after the investigation was reopened, Richard Garrett made a shocking discovery. Another case, strangely similar to Don and Kevin's. In 1984, in Hodgen, Oklahoma, two young men, Billy Hainline and Dennis Decker, were run over by a train. They were lying motionless, side by side on the tracks, positions nearly identical to Kevin and Don's. Their deaths were ruled accidental as well, and there was no investigation. It was reported that their blood alcohol level was near the legal limit, so police theorized the boys were intoxicated, fell asleep on the tracks, and were hit. The two cases are eerily similar, but there's never been any definitive connection between the two. Richard Garrett believed that Kevin and Don were murdered, and to cover their tracks, the assailant or assailants laid them on the railroad tracks and covered them up with a tarp. And before working on this case, Richard Garrett said he never carried a gun. But after joining the investigation, he began carrying one as he felt his life was in danger. Kevin and Don's families spent years fighting for justice, spending hours at the spot where the teens were killed, wondering how it all happened. They believe that Kevin and Don walked up on something that they were not supposed to see. Wrong place, wrong time. Specifically, something illegal. At that time, Arkansas had a rampant drug problem. Mena, a town just a few hours away from where the boys were murdered, was a hub for activity. In the 1980s, the Mena Airport was the reported base of drug smuggling, money laundering, and arms smuggling. And there's been a lot of talk that the boys could have stumbled upon a drug drop that night and were murdered for what they saw. Some may hear that and think, sounds a little far-fetched. But maybe it's not. There was a lot of bad stuff going on in this area. There was also another really strange tip. In June 1988, a local man named Ronnie Godwin came forward claiming the night of the murders, he witnessed two police officers near a grocery store near the train tracks, and he said there were two teen boys with them. Ronnie said something seemed really off, though, as one of the teen boys was kneeling on the ground with his head down, and the other boy had been shoved up against a phone booth by a cop. Then the cops put the teens into the cop car and drove off. So when he heard about Don and Kevin's deaths, he went to police with this. To this day, it's not known if the boys were Kevin and Don, but many believe this could be further proof of a big, massive cover-up in this case. In the years since, new detectives and investigators who were brought onto the force have stated that large parts of the boys' case files are missing, such as an evidence list. And along with this, there is reportedly a strong discouragement from colleagues in looking into the case. In later years, it was revealed that Dr. Malik had made over 20 incorrect rulings throughout his career. But he was never penalized. In fact, he kept his job and was even given raises. In 1996, Linda Ives, Kevin's mom, was approached by a film producer named Patrick Mastrosana. He was really interested in the case and wanted to release a documentary. And he did, titled Obstruction of Justice, The Mena Connection. The 1996 film detailed the botched investigation into the boys' murders. It also looked into the alleged drug ring in Saline County, which ran out of the Mena Airport, And the film claimed it was covered up by police. This documentary alleged that Kevin and Don were killed after they accidentally witnessed a drug deal that involved top state officials, claiming their bodies were laid on the train tracks so a train would run them over and destroy evidence. Numerous people were implicated in this, including investigators, state and federal prosecutors, and grand juries. And there was a laundry list of something like 8 people who were at one point involved in this investigation who mysteriously died or vanished within the decade. And in the documentary, 2 veteran sheriff's deputies named Jay Campbell and Kirk Lane were alleged to be the killers, alleging those were the 2 officers that witness saw with the teen boys in the parking lot the night of the murders. In turn, the 2 officers denied any involvement in the murders and actually sued Patrick and his film company for defamation. But a court eventually ruled in Patrick's favor, as he really didn't do anything wrong. And now it gets even deeper. Former Saline County prosecuting attorney Dan Harmon, the one I said the boys' families grew close with, investigated the case, even presenting evidence to a grand jury, he later served time in prison on federal drug and racketeering charges. Linda said that when she first met Dan Harmon, she trusted him, only later coming to believe that he was involved. An ex-girlfriend of Dan Harmon's reportedly told an investigator that Dan Harmon and 2 other men were responsible for the murders, but he was never charged in the case or officially labeled a suspect. But it just goes to show how twisted this case really is. In 2018, there was a shocking confession. Billy Jack Haynes, who was a well-known wrestler in the 80s, claimed that he witnessed the murders of Kevin and Don on August 23rd. Billy claimed that he used to be a drug trafficker and a hired enforcer during the 80s, and was introduced to a drug dealer politician from Arkansas. He said, quote, "In August 1987, I was contacted by the Arkansas criminal politician and was asked if I would provide muscle at an Arkansas drug stop. The criminal politician suspected that some drug money drops were being stolen," end quote. Now, this politician was never named publicly, but while quote-unquote conducting security during the alleged drug purchase, Haynes said he witnessed the murders of Don and Kevin. He also claimed that the politician believed police officers were involved in the theft of the drug money, and that the teens were murdered by people who were, quote, "working for the same criminal politician," end quote. He said he met Linda Ives in 2016 and gave her names of everyone involved. Linda Ives said she was hopeful someone in law enforcement, either local, state, or federal, would look into Haynes' confession. She said in an interview, quote, "I don't know that there will ever be justice here on earth, but you have to keep trying. You know they would like for you to think that this case is just old and complicated and there isn't any way to solve it, but that's not true. That is not true. This case is solvable," end quote. Linda searched for justice and answers in her son's murder for years, up until her death in 2021. And to this day, this case remains unsolved. Most believe this entire case is one huge, massive cover-up, but there are still so many questions. The unsolved killings of Kevin Ives and Don Henry is one of the most high-profile homicide cases in Arkansas history. And hopefully, by keeping this cold case alive, one day, there will be justice. Better late than never. Until next episode, this is Avery After Dark.